Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight's guest goes by the name Recluse. He's an author and longtime publisher of the blog Visup, V-I-S-U-P, which delves into the occult, mind control, deep state dealings, sacred geometry, and every surrounding rabbit hole. Next year, we should see the release of his first book. He is currently working on his second, which explores the origins of the network brought to light by the Epstein revelations, beginning with its emergence during the years between the world wars and continuing into the 1980s. Recluse, how you doing tonight?
Doing well, Chris. How are you doing tonight?
Very good. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I've been looking forward to tonight. We're always hearing terms like the deep state, shadow government, but what does it really consist of, and how much control do these shadowy factions really have? Who are the players, and what is the end game? I'd like to talk about all of that. I want to go as deep as we can, but first I'd like to know what got you into this research.
Well, I mean, there were a couple of different factors. I mean, one that I've talked about a lot was just kind of my relationship with my father. He had been in the military during the 1950s. I'm still kind of trying to sort out his background there, but I believe he was in some kind of Army intelligence unit, though. He never really talked to me about it, but he did spend a decent amount of his career at Fort Meade, which is the headquarters of the NSA. So, I mean, he might have been on detachment there or something. But anyway, he was really a big conspiracy buff. I kind of can remember listening to, like, William Cooper way back in the early mid-90s when I was only like maybe 10 or 11, you know, on the shortwave radio and that type of thing. So he definitely always kind of put the interest into my head. And then later on, kind of in a totally different related or unrelated thing, was it was actually, I think, the first really psychedelic trip I had taken. It was on magic mushrooms. This was back when I was at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs back in 2004. And I remember it was later at night, and I had gone into the cafeteria there, to get something to eat, or actually really just to kind of walk around because I was feeling rambunctious, and walk in there, and it looked like I was in a spaceship, started seeing aliens and stuff everywhere. So I had become really interested in that, and that had led me to the Spirit Molecule by, I can't remember the guy's name there, but it was about the DMT experiments that they had done, and I believe it was like the University of New Mexico back in like the early 90s, and that was also a frequent occurrence, as well as sometimes illnesses, especially cancer, that had been linked to that, and that had sort of brought up, you know, as I researched more, connections to remote viewing and a lot of these other sort of, you know, arcane pursuits that had been experimented with by the CIA and the Pentagon and whatnot. So, I mean, it really opened my eyes to sort of like the background to psychedelics, and that made me very curious, as to what the motive was for all of this.
When it comes to these shadowy factions and what you would call the deep state nowadays, there's so many layers and so many rabbit holes we could go down. But I guess tonight we could start with, I guess, the dark occult aspect. Where did this all start? I mean, did it come along with Project Paperclip, or was it something before that?
Well, I mean, certainly I think it would have gone back even further with the British. I mean, and you have to kind of factor in most of our own intelligence services. I mean, the OSS was essentially set up by Sir William Stevenson, codenamed Intrepid. He had overseen the British security coordination in the United States during the 1940s, before the United States had even entered the war, and he was essentially working for MI6 in this capacity. He had befriended Donovan. He compromised American senators. He helped set up the OSS. He helped, get the debt erased, essentially, for Lyndon Lease and so forth. So our intelligence legacy is very much one that is closely related with the British, and the British at the same time, I mean, have used occultists for probably centuries now. I mean, it really, you could go back to the first modern, or not modern, but I mean, the first sort of proto-intelligence service that the UK had in Elizabethan England, set up by Robert Cecil, that ended up becoming involved with John Dee and so forth, going into the more recent eras. Of course, Crowley was largely believed to have been an intelligence asset of the British. Certainly, there's a lot of compelling evidence that he was involved in some of the shenanigans in the Second World War. War with Rudolf Hess and so forth. I mean, this also kind of involved a guy named Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond, who had been detached to MI6 in the First World War, who had gone on to work as the head of their naval intelligence during the Second World War. He was also close to Bill Stevenson. So, I mean, you kind of have this, you know, network where you've got Stevenson here working with Donovan to set up the OSS, and then at the same time, he's in league with Fleming, who's in league with Crowley, and, you know, I definitely think that this sort of led the inspiration for some of this interest in the arcane, and this was certainly bolstered further, as you're saying, with the paperclip era when we started bringing in the Nazis, who had their own kind of peculiar interest in the subject as well.
Who is really in control? I mean, is it just one faction, or are there different competing factions for control? And how does this, you know, how is it this pyramid structured?
Well, I mean, yeah, I definitely think there are different, you know, competing factions. And I mean, a lot of it really goes back to the old world. You have kind of the Vatican faction. You have the sort of, you know, right-wing British faction that's becoming closely in league with the American far right in recent years. You've got kind of the neoliberal establishment that grew up on Wall Street and so forth, who have really been the predominant faction for much of the 20th century. But I'm kind of of the opinion that their influence has been waning a lot in the 21st. So certainly, and I mean, you know, this isn't, you know, these different sides aren't necessarily all in opposition all the time. I mean, they agree on certain things. They disagree on other disputes. Sides can change very fluidly. It's not necessarily a, you know, a neat, orderly package. And I think that really is an underlining factor behind a lot of the chaos we're seeing now. I mean, I know a lot of people kind of like to think that everything has been controlled and plotted out to the last detail, but I think that tends to give the elite more credit than they deserve. And I think especially in this day and age, we're sort of seeing the unforeseen consequences, if you will, of these kind of, you know, deep rivalries that have been ongoing for quite a considerable amount of time now.
Yeah, and it seems that we see this far right faction trying to gain power again, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, in the States, I mean, they really went to an apex initially during the Reagan years. I mean, that was when you really started to see the, you know, American Security Council and Council on National Policy crowd really start to have a major position in the American establishment. Now, when the Cold War came to an end, this sort of threw the right into disarray for a little while. I mean, there were different, you know, kind of realignments of factions. You had sort of the Zionists on the one hand who were really behind the neocons who have long been despised by the old kind of fascist right. So, I mean, there was kind of those conflicts. But certainly, I think there was a galvanization going into the 21st century, mending of fences, so to speak, and that kind of led to the, you know, current state we're in now with Brexit and Trump and so forth.
Now, going back, I'd like to talk a little bit about how these strange black projects got started. It seems like after World War II, there were just a barrage of these projects. Could you talk maybe more about some of the more profound ones that had an effect on our current society, like Artichoke or Bluebird?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, these are usually described as, you know, mind control experiments and something to that effect. But this is actually going to be the topic essentially of the third book I'm going to do after the one on Epstein's finished. But I mean, to me, the real purpose of these projects essentially was to weaponize consciousness itself. Okay. I mean, because this is, to my mind, the only really reasonable explanation. I mean, yes, we hear a lot about, you know, the LSD and the other psychedelics that were involved in this, but I mean, LSD is simply not a good substance for, you know, mind control or something to that effect. I mean, really, you know, tyrants throughout history, if they wanted to cripple a population, they used opiates. Psychedelics are a little more unpredictable. But I mean, beyond that, I mean, there was so much other crazy stuff. Jungian psychology, UFOs, S training, just all kinds of crazy stuff. All the remote viewing stuff and what have you that really grew out of Artichoke, and specifically the research of Andrea Puharic. I mean, the really reoccurring theme of all of this is consciousness and how it can be manipulated. And I think that's kind of the mother of all black projects, so to speak. And a lot of the things that have been going onward are sort of reverberations of what was started with that. So, I mean, obviously that would be a touchstone. And then kind of going into the 80s, you have the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, quote unquote. There's obviously been a lot of speculation over the years. You know, was it just a boondoggle that, you know, all of these billions of dollars were squandered on, you know, gold-plated toilet seats or something to that effect? Or was there actually legitimate black research being conducted? I tend to think it was a bit, you know, in between. There was a lot of bogus stuff. There was probably also a lot of money that was siphoned off for really, you know, dark projects, possibly the weaponization of space, possibly some kind of crazy aircrafts. I don't really know. But, you know, this is kind of how the system has been gearing towards in recent years, and that is having more of it go into the deep private, less of it even under the control of the directly of the government itself or the Pentagon. And that's kind of what I think was really significant about the Epstein revelations and so forth. We're kind of seeing how you had this vast slush fund of illicit money from sex trafficking, drug trafficking, and so forth. And a lot of it was actually going into the coffers of cutting edge science, essentially. So, I mean, you know, I think that's essentially what, you know, the direction it's been heading now for years.
Now, do you think some of these mind control black projects were integrated into some of the things we're seeing now working against our society, like the way they use media against us, say?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is something about, you know, MK Ultra. I've only really recently kind of started to discover, specifically in the research of the book I've got coming out with Frank Zero and Jack Knight next year, or Jeremy Knight, sorry. But essentially, one of the components of MK Ultra was an organization known as the Society, I believe, for the Study of Human Ecology or something to that effect. It was one of the major funding conduits for MKUltra. It had gotten a lot of money from the Rockefeller family and so forth. And I came to find out that one of the guys who had been a very high figure in it was a guy named Colonel James Monroe. And during the same time Monroe was active in this, you know, MKUltra stuff, he was also a participant in some of the organizations affiliated with the American Security Council, which was for many years a kind of the equivalent of the Council of Foreign Relations for the American far right, if you will. Now, the ASC was a lot of things. It was partly a vast private intelligence network that was engaged in blacklisting and so forth, but it was also a propaganda outfit. It disseminated a lot of disinformation, and some of it was even, you know, really subtle, going into, you know, more fringe groups like the Minutemen, which was the first really major post Cold War era, you know, militia group, and the John Birch Society and the Liberty Lobby. This is where a lot of, like, your, you know, typical Alex Jones New World Order conspiracy theories come from. And then, of course, the ASC had more sophisticated things related to the so-called missile gap and so forth. And this all had a very, you know, troubling effect on the nation. I mean, the ASC was at the forefront of just really militant Cold War era propaganda that was supposed to terrify the public with the threat of nuclear annihilation, of a missile gap being destroyed by the Soviet Union. And you have this, you know, MK Ultra guy, James Monroe, who's there in the early days helping them set up these psychological operations. He befriended a guy who was very big in the American Security Council called Frank Burnett, who would later go on to set up another major tank. What was it? The NSIC, the National Security. Oh, shoot. I can't remember what the abbreviations stand for off the top of my head. I didn't realize we'd get into this, but it had a lot of heavies in it. It had William Casey in it, the future director of the CIA, and so forth. And all of this was really related to psychological warfare, and this was being promoted by James Monroe. So there's definitely this component of psychological warfare that was part of MK Ultra that really has not generated a lot of research, which is very unfortunate, because, like you're saying, I mean, this could really be a significant breakthrough to sort of see how these techniques were applied to mass psychology, if you will.
When you look at some of the things happening right now, you know, some of the movement, some of the division, the transhumanism movement, do you think that this has all sort of, you know, been in the works for a long time?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, I've gotten into my blog about how, I mean, Epstein had been funding the transhumanist movement for several years now. And I mean, there were other, I mean, kind of heavies behind it. I mean, one of them was the grandson of Milton Friedman and what have you. I mean, I don't think that these, you know, ideals just kind of sprang out of the blue, so to speak. I'm sure that this had been something within the elite that had been kind of gradually speculated upon for several years before it really started to make its appearance. And the, I guess transhumanism really started to catch on in like, what, around the late 90s or something like that. And even before then, you kind of have the echoes and the, you know, cyberpunk novels and what have you that were so big in the 1980s, and which also influenced a lot of the transhumanism in turn. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's been in the works for a while now.
Now, when you go back to black projects like MK Ultra and all these other mind control projects, what happened to them? I know they couldn't have just been discontinued. Were they continued in other projects? And are there any similar projects that may be going on right now?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, like one of the things I always like to harp on because it gets, you know, misinterpreted so much, but MK Ultra and Artichoke were separate programs. That's a big mistake a lot of people make. They were never rolled into one another. They both continued. Artichoke
Recluse? Subproject. You cut out there for about a few seconds. Hello, you there? Hello.
Can you hear me? Yeah. Sorry about that. I think my one internet.
No, that's all good. Me? Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, cool.
All right.
Yeah, sorry. I think my one internet went out. So fortunately, I've got a backup. It kind of comes in handy when you live out in the middle of nowhere.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. Awesome. All right. Well, you're back, and we were talking about the possible continued black project, such as MK Ultra and Artichoke.
Yeah, so, you know, anyway, obviously these projects were kind of formally rolled up in the 70s, and then you had MK Often, which kind of preceded or succeeded these operations. That continued on to about the late 1970s, and that was at the point when you started to have a lot of the revelations coming out from the Church Committee and so forth. And certainly, I don't think this stuff just ended in the late 1970s, but I do think it ended in a official capacity, and a lot of it was sent into the deep private from there on out. And I kind of think, you know, we caught a bit of a glimpse of that with the Cambridge Analytica revelations that started to come out in recent years with the, you know, the implications that it had on the election in 2016 and also the implications it had on Brexit. Of course, Cambridge Analytica was an organization that was later a part of, what was it called? Sorry, I'm forgetting the name now. The SLC Group, which had been set up as the Strategic Communications Laboratories back in the early 90s. I mean, it was essentially a privatized psychological warfare effort that had been enlisted by, that had been set up by people affiliated with MI6 and so forth. So, you know, here you're essentially going on to use kind of cutting edge technology to kind of carry out these psychological operations. But this time around, you don't even really have much of a semblance of the official security services being involved. You just have a private company that is engaging in a psychological warfare operation against the US and the UK with backing from, you know, far right financiers in the United States like Peter Thiel and the Mercer family and the DeVos family and the Prince family, and then the UK from a lot of, you know, the old aristocracy. I mean, families like the Mountbattens that have been, you know, linked to child rape and so forth for decades now. So, you know, in a lot of ways, this is kind of the future. I mean, it's not even a department of the or a subsection of the CIA that's carrying this stuff out anymore. It's a private corporation that's doing it.
Where do you think we're going as far as, you know, I don't follow any kind of politics. I think that all the presidents are basically puppets. There's someone else pulling the strings. But what been going on, especially with the election of are they trying to steer us in a certain direction here?
Well, I mean, yeah, I definitely think the election of Trump in a lot of ways was, you know, an attempt to try to reorient things, especially the international order. I mean, I think at least in one side of the coin, there's kind of a realization that the neoliberal order is doomed. You know, we're trying to go back to probably something more akin to what the British were doing with their balance of power politics. I also think there's an attempt to really enhance the Anglo-American special relationship, so to speak. Of course, you know, the British and the U.S. have kind of been at odds at times in the, throughout the Cold War era. Sometimes they work very closely, sometimes they haven't, but it definitely seems like in recent years, with the rise of Euroscepticism in the UK on the one hand, on the flip side of the coin in the United States, with the real militancy that began with the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, that really jettisoned the whole UN framework that his father had exploited to great effect with the first Gulf War in exchange for a so-called coalition of the willing, which was essentially just the US and the UK. In a lot of ways, I think we're kind of going back to the original purpose of Quigley's Round Table Group, which was not exactly this sort of, UN-derived world government that conspiracy theorists are obsessed with, but really was simply meant to be a continuation of the British Empire by bringing the United States into the fold as the muscle and the bank, so to speak. Of course, centuries past, the roles are a little different now. The British are probably, simply a sub-partner in it. But I do think there is kind of this push with the far right liberal order, which is really petering out, to put it mildly, right now.
Right, and there's such a huge division right now in our country, and it's very obviously orchestrated by the media. They want straight people to hate gay people. They want women to hate men. Black people to hate white people. It's an obvious divide and conquer tactic. What do you think the end game with this is?
Well, some of this sort of plays into theories that were developed by the Mont Pelerin Society. I believe that's how it sounds. I don't take my word for that. But the MPS was really at the forefront of the modern libertarian movement, if you will. The Austrian School of Economics derives from it. The Chicago School of Economics derives from it, and so forth. And one of the concepts that many of the economists linked to this group became smitten with was the notion of a double government. And essentially, this would entail having what was considered to be the crucial aspects, and those were what was related to the economy, to taxes and things like that, essentially closed off from popular democracy. It would be, these policies would be set by trained advisors and corporations and so forth. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you had the public form of government, which was meant to be dealt with social issues like abortion or, something to that effect, which I don't think a lot of people at the upper echelons of power really care about. But it is an issue that a lot of normal people are passionate about. And it's a good way to get people angry. It's a good way to get them in the streets to ignore the fact that they've seen their standard of living plummeting for years now, that their, country is being sold off en masse, that their jobs are being, outsourced, that they're soon to be completely replaced by AIs and that kind of thing. And that's the type of stuff that the elites do not want, there to be a public debate about. They want you to focus on topics. Gun control would be another one, for example. I mean, I don't care how you feel about it, but you can put all the laws on the books you want to try to stop the flow of guns into this country. It's not going to work. It's not going to work any better than Prohibition worked or the war on drugs worked for a variety of reasons. And it simply is creating a frivolous debate about, a subject of whether or not guns should be legal that really is not going to change much of anything. The guns are still going to be here, people. It's not, all the laws in the world are not going to change that.
How far do you think they're going to go with this censorship? We've seen a huge rash of it lately, on YouTube's alternative media sources, just, getting rid of them, completely silencing them. The idea is with this, and how far would this go?
I mean, I think it's definitely going to go pretty far, certainly with just how much the mainstream media has been discredited, especially since 2016 and so forth. I mean, I don't know that the kind of neoliberal establishment really has much choice. They have to try to crush whatever alternative, dissent that they can find. And then on top of that, so much of this is also intertwined with the far right faction, which really had to rely much more on the internet, on social media and things of that nature, because they don't have the same control over the mass media that the neoliberal faction does. So it's partly kind of a way to crack down against your adversaries, but it's also a way to crack down essentially, you know, on the public's ability to be informed and gather alternative perspectives on the things that are unfolding in the world now. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely a major component, I would say, on the one hand, of the ongoing deep state civil war. And as such, you know, I think anything can go with that. And certainly there's also the component of also trying to keep the public in the dark, which has become more crucial as the faith in the mainstream media erodes by the day amongst the American public and those in Europe and so forth.
Where does the whole sex trafficking aspect come from? I mean, this is now come to light. More and more people are getting exposed on the pedophilia and sex trafficking. But where does that come from? Where did it start? And the shadow government always been involved with this?
I mean, yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, certainly in the recent years, you know, with the emergence of what is known as a honey trap or a honey pot or something to that effect. And I mean, you know, again, I think this is probably something that went back to the British. There's been some speculation that this might have tied in with Crowley and some other, you know, arcane things. I don't really know. I haven't researched that thoroughly to my satisfaction. But I mean, certainly, you know, we kind of brought up earlier the British security coordination. One of the things I found out about in their attempts to influence the American public, for instance, prior to America's entry in the Second World War, was the use of honey traps. And one of the big fish they targeted was Arthur Vandenberg, who was a huge isolationist senator in that era. America First Committee, all of that stuff, very opposed to the UK, did not want the United States in the war. They got Vandenberg ensnared with one of their agents, and essentially they used that as blackmail to get his consent for America's entry, and then later to essentially wipe a lot of the debt for Lyndon Lee. So, you know, this is something you can go back to the Second World War, and you can see that the budding intelligence services in the United States were probably in a position to pick this up from the British and might even have been involved in some of these operations. I mean, another really notorious female asset that was used for this kind of stuff was known as Cynthia, and she was another chick who had worked with both the OSS and the PSC during this era. So in our, you know, particular history, I think that's where it came from. The British were obviously up to this, you know, even further. And then on top of that, there's also the, you know, kind of component from organized crime as well. Of course, there's been a lot of speculation over the years that Hoover essentially did everything in his power to deny the existence of the mafia and then essentially cover up for it when it was no longer you know, deniable, because many years ago, probably during the 30s, the mafia had gotten, you know, film or pictures or something of Hoover engaged in some kind of homosexual liaison. So you had more organized crime factoring into the American political system and the deep state itself. Some of these methods were probably also brought in. But I mean, certainly, you know, there was a lot of this going on from different factors that would influence how the American security services would continue to operate themselves. And this has just really become, you know, epidemic. I mean, going into some of the revelations with Gladio, the kind of stay-behind network that was set up in Italy, it was overseen by the Masonic Lodge, P2, and it's known that, again, the Grand Master of this, Lucio Gelli, had also acquired compromising files. It was never necessarily stated that it was implicitly sexual, but certainly some of them would have been. Essentially, to join P2, you had to turn over compromising information both on yourself and other members and people that the organization was even interested in recruiting. And I'm guessing that, you know, this kind of control system was not unique to that. It probably been, you know, some factor in that that's been used for years now, and it's growing, and it's created a situation now where probably almost every major figure has been compromised in some sense or another.
Now, when it comes to control, the church and most namely the Vatican has been more in the background in modern time. Do they still hold much control?
Yeah, I definitely think the Vatican does. I mean, the Vatican is just, you know, absolutely loaded with money. I mean, I believe it's still the largest, you know, single landholder in the entire world, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, the Vatican was for years a major player within the Socla, which was essentially the far right's answer to the Bilderberg group, and some of the quote unquote chivalric orders, the, you know, Knights of Malta, Opus Dei, the Legionaries of Christ. A lot of these groups are extremely wealthy. They're extremely powerful. In the case of the Knights of Malta, they've been around for nearly 1,000 years. On the flip side of the coin, you also have the Jesuits, which have tended to be somewhat more closely associated with the liberal faction. They're, you know, a bit in power now with Pope Francis. But yeah, I mean, these organizations definitely have a lot of influence, maybe even more so than the mainline Vatican itself now, but they, I would say, are certainly still major players in the game. I mean, I just, you know, organizations like the Knights of Malta didn't survive for centuries as they have now with not, you know, knowing a thing or two about espionage.
I haven't done much research into the whole Epstein saga. I know he was tied to sex trafficking. I know he didn't kill himself, but I'd like to hear more about what his whole role was. And, you know, how much power did he have when it comes to things that were going on behind the scenes?
Well, I mean, I don't think Epstein was a figurehead or anything. I tend to think that he was probably just the guy who, you know, handled the day-to-day operations and so forth. And I mean, he really seems to have come up in the 1980s in New York in the same, you know, crowd that Donald Trump was a major figure of. I've seen accounts that he was close to Roy Cohn, Trump's notorious attorney, who was kind of his political mentor and who has himself been linked to child sex trafficking for many years. These guys were also very closely in league with what I like to think of as the Drexel Burnham clique, or mafia might be a better indication. But Drexel Burnham was the firm that was used primarily by the junk bond king, Mr. Michael Milken. Milken obviously went down in the 1980s, but a lot of his associates have continued on and still are actually currently wield a tremendous amount of power. Of course, there was Trump himself. He never worked directly with Milken on a lot of projects, but Milken's casino advisor was essentially who helped Trump break into that industry. You also had other figures like Leon Black, who was close to Jeffrey Epstein. Leon Black had worked for Drexel Burnham directly under Milken. Leon Black is a major backer of the Kushner family and so forth. He's been close to Trump, from what I can tell, for many years. They were both kind of involved in the early, you know, capitalist ventures into Russia in the early 90s when the Soviet Union was coming to a close and so forth. And he also owns, through his holding company, Apollo Capital, Constellus, which is essentially kind of a super mercenary outfit. It owns Triple Canopy and the PMC, formerly known as Blackwater. I don't know what it's calling itself this week, but during the last decade, those were two of the three major private military companies in the United States, along with DynCorp. They're now both, two of those three are now owned by Constellus, and Constellus is owned by Leon Black's company. Okay, so you've also got Stephen Feinberg. He's currently the president, the chairman of the President's Advisory Board on Foreign, I can't remember what it's called, but it's the council, the unofficial council that essentially advises the president on intelligence matters. Feinberg's the chair of that. He cut his teeth at Drexel Burnham. He also knew Milken. He's also the owner of DynCorp, for that matter, as well. So, you know, there's just this really weird network that included all these Drexel Burnham figures. They also seem to have ties to the Russian mafia. There was connections to Epstein in this group. And then Epstein himself seems to have been set up with Ghislaine Maxwell, his reputed madam, by Donald Trump. So certainly I tend to think that in some sense, Epstein is probably a continuation of the network that Roy Cohn had started, that he had overseen for many years, that later included a lot of people like Trump and the Drexel Burnham, who essentially was probably the guy tasked with managing the day-to-day operation, so to speak, and probably also set up as the potential fall guy if something went wrong.
What were some of the, I guess, bullet points you could say that led up to his arrest, some of the things that happened behind the scenes?
Well, I just think after a while, the investigations had gone on and so forth, but I mean, also, I think a lot of it has been kind of an attempt to go after Trump's opponents in the Democratic Party. And I mean, it's not necessarily just Epstein. I kind of think some of the revelations that came out about Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey are related to this too. I mean, of course, Epstein was very close to a lot of Democratic loyalty, I mean, we've heard a lot about the Clintons. There was the King family from Mexico, Bruce Richardson, and so on and so forth. And definitely, I think there's a good chance that Epstein was essentially the guy who was, you know, compiling a lot of the control files on prominent Democrats. So as the pressure to try to do something against Trump in terms of an impeachment or something like that has grown on the one side of the coin, I think you've started to see more and more of this stuff gradually trickling out. And I think it's kind of a way to go after the donors of the Democratic Party, to go after prominent politicians and so forth. And also, probably from Trump's perspective, most importantly, to ensure that he doesn't go to jail.
Now, he was also involved in some strange black projects as well, right?
Epstein or Trump?
Epstein.
Yeah, I mean, like I've written about this on my blog, but yeah, certainly. I mean, Epstein appears to have been quite taken with eugenics. He, as I kind of went on before, he's done a lot with the transhumanist movement. He was a major backer of Humanity Plus, which also had some of these neo-reactionary cretins linked to it. He was also, just in general, a major proponent of AI, but he also seems to have really become enamored with genetic research in recent years as well, which is especially ominous. In fact, I've seen him essentially described as a genetics investor, which was what he did for really the last 10 or 15 years of his life or so forth. So, you know, I mean, Epstein doesn't even really seem to have tried to hide the fact that, I mean, he was no longer really involved in hedge fund management or anything like that. He was simply doing this bizarre scientific research that seems to have been genuinely driven by his own interests in eugenics. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely some very shady things that have come out with this in recent months, I should say. And definitely, I don't know if we're going to continue with this, but, I mean, the little we've gotten out has just been, to my perspective, just shocking.
Now, there are those theories that think, you know, he didn't die, that he went to Israel, or, you know, that there's some people that think he really did kill himself. Of course, I don't think he killed himself. I think he was killed. What are your thoughts on the whole death?
I mean, I think he's most likely dead. I mean, I just think that that would probably eliminate problems as easily, you know, as trying to smuggle him out of a major national security prison. But I mean, anything's possible, but I just think that probably the simplest thing would have been to do is just, you know, kill him.
Okay. Now, for those that are out there going along with the QAnon movement and saying that Trump is going to save us from the deep state, you know, what are your thoughts on that whole thing and the fact that there's people out there that think he's our savior from the shadow government?
Yeah, I usually encourage them to just read my blog, but even then it doesn't really seem to work. I mean, I don't know how many comments I've gotten, something to the effect of like, sure, Trump is evil and involved with pedophiles and what have you, but thank God the Clintons weren't elected. Yeah. I don't even really know what to say to this kind of stuff sometimes. I mean, Trump is just absolutely corrupt. He's deep state to the core. He's probably been deep state to the core since, I mean, really his rise in the early 80s. I mean, he was groomed by Roy Cohn, for God's sake. I mean, just a guy who was, you know, knee deep in any number of intrigues for decades. I mean, I've gone into my blog how he played a central role in the Profumo scandal, which, you know, effectively brought down the government of Harold Macmillan in the UK, which might have brought down Kennedy's government in the US if he had lived. You know, this was a guy that wielded a tremendous amount of power, and this was the guy who showed Donald Trump the ropes. And he's continued to be in the same, you know, circle with, I mean, a lot of these different figures over the years. I mean, of course, you also have the association with Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell's father. Robert Maxwell was an intelligence asset for the Mossad, for the KGB, for MI6. You know, I mean, almost all the major ones out there. Maxwell and Trump were also close. I mean, I believe Robert Maxwell was actually the one who had originally set his daughter up, Ghislaine, with Trump in the first place. Ghislaine had actually tried to go to Trump in the late 80s to get some kind of investment ventures until Bob had figured out and sent a stopper from it because he thought that Trump would think she was a fool. Who knows? But I mean, you know, clearly Trump had known Maxwell for a lot of years. Maxwell was a big guy in the intelligence community. He was also knee-deep in a lot of scientific espionage. He was probably a major figure in the illicit proceeds of arms trafficking that was being generated during the whole Iran-Contra era. I mean, these were, you know, guys like Maxwell and Cohn. I mean, these were heavies, big, big guys in the deep state. And, you know, these were the kinds of sharks that Trump, you know, came into his own around. So Trump is definitely a shark. He's a part of this establishment. He's not... The only thing he's battling are his, you know, rivals within the establishment. But, I mean, certainly he's not there to save the general public. I mean, not by a wide margin.
Do you think that they're going to try and go with more of the same for 2020? Or you think they're going to try and switch up the game?
I mean, yeah, I think Trump is all but a shoo-in to win in 2020. I mean, I just don't really see a Democratic candidate that's going to be able to rally the corporate donors and the populace at large. And I mean, if they even try to nominate Hillary again for 2020, I just think that's going to, I mean, that could potentially be the end of the Democratic Party as we currently know it. Certainly, I know quite a few liberals, pretty far left types, I mean, who would consider themselves progressives and so forth, I mean, who absolutely despise Hillary. So, if anything, it almost seems like the Democratic Party is trying to commit suicide, so to speak, possibly because of the looming economic collapse. A lot of people think that it's going to start coming after 2020, and it would not go well if they were in power, I'm guessing, but who knows? Certainly, I think it's Martin Armstrong, the prominent economist, had predicted major civil unrest beginning in 2024. That could be an offshoot of another 4 years of Trump and economic collapse that goes out in his administration, and then going into the 2024 election cycle when the when the bullets and the fists really start to fly, so to speak.
Now, but no matter, you know, who gets in there, it's all controlled. I mean, they're not really, they don't really have any power. There's always someone else behind the scenes that's pulling the strings, right?
Well, I mean, I think there are legitimate debates. I mean, a big one in terms of foreign policy right now, I think, is the issue of Russia versus China. I mean, a lot of people in the neoliberal establishment are generally pro-China. This is certainly true of the Clintons and so forth, whereas conversely, they tend to be very anti-Russian. And this is essentially the opposite of Trump and a lot of his backers, who tend to be very anti-China and to some extent pro-Russia. So, I mean, I do think there is, for instance, a legitimate debate over who is the principal enemy that the United States should be focusing on going into the 2020s and so forth. So that's definitely something at play. And certainly, I mean, if they really crack down on China, that would essentially topple the neoliberal order that's really prevailed in, you know, since the end of the Second World War. I mean, China was really, I think, intended to be kind of the linchpin of this, so to speak. And, you know, now I think there's definitely a very strong push to kind of bring those plans to a halt by a certain faction of the deep states.
You briefly mentioned the economic collapse. Do you foresee something like this happening within the next 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there's a good chance. I mean, in a lot of ways, we've really just been kicking the can for years now, going back to kind of the dot-com bubble that burst in the late 90s, going into the housing, you know, meltdown that occurred at the tail end of the Bush 2 years, and that spurred the economic crisis into 2008 and so forth. I mean, really, those problems were never resolved. We just essentially tried to print our way out of it, and, you know, that's not something that is sustainable. So I definitely think going into the next decade, it's really going to be difficult to find a way to try to extend this, you know, any longer. I think a lot of the tricks have been exhausted, and that's, you know, another factor that a lot of the powers behind the scenes are trying to, you know, put themselves in positions to survive or exploit or whatever the case may be.
Something that has become very popular is the UFO phenomenon. It's been all over the media. I've never seen, you know, as much coverage of UFO topics on mainstream media before, but there seems to be something else behind it. And even going back to, you know, Roswell incident, there seemed to be something, it seemed to be a cover for something else, possibly something more spiritual or interdimensional. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely think so. And this is something that we might actually kind of see as part of the broader intention of things like MK Ultra and Artichoke. Because I mentioned earlier, I mean, UFOs were actually investigated by both programs. I mean, there's definitely more on MK Ultra's foray into these topics. But I mean, this was certainly something that the people involved in that were interested in. So, you know, it does kind of beg the question, you go forward and you start seeing, organizations like the Noetic Science Institute spring up, which had ties to some of these kind of poobahs like Adriana Proharik, who had been a member of Artichoke, participated in Artichoke, who had also been an influence in some of the people that set up these later, you know, kind of new age type outfits that were really instrumental in spawning these kind of quote unquote UFO cults beginning in the 60s and the 70s and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, this is what I kind of was getting at with the weaponization of consciousness, so to speak. Was this, you know, an attempt to genuinely create a new kind of spirituality? I would have thought that that was absurd, you know, several years ago. But after some of the research I've done on this topic, I really don't think it is anymore. And I think we're kind of starting to see some of the end game playing out, but at least, you know, for one faction. Of course, on the other hand, you've got, you know, this other crazy stuff like Neo-Raction, or aka the Dark Enlightenment and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, this is a component of some of these black projects. This is, you know, not just, I mean, in terms of like whether or not we have reverse engineered UFOs or what have you, but just the general effect it's having on the public conception of reality, really. I mean, it's just really amazing to see all this playing out.
I find it fascinating that something involved with these black projects was communing with otherworldly beings. You know, they have the story of the CIA's offices of security and the Nine. I mean, some of this stuff is just, you know, unbelievable.
Yeah, and I mean, again, this is something that I thought was really crazy, but after years of looking at this, I definitely think that at least some factions genuinely felt that LSD or something or some of these other methods could be used to contact non-human intelligence. And that definitely takes on some very disturbing implications when you look at how LSD was gradually spread to the public at large beginning in the 1960s. And like I was getting into with some of these, you know, new age movements and what have you that started springing up around the same time. I mean, I definitely think that there were people involved in these projects, and there were certainly a lot of, you know, individuals who were just typical conservative scientists and what have you, but there were definitely, I think, some people who felt that there was a real spiritual component to these things.
It makes me wonder, if they were doing that back then, what have they learned from it, and what are they doing now as a result?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the million-dollar question, and I mean, especially as you're starting to see more of this stuff come back to the forefront, is really the Christian fundamentalist movement has been dying off, and that in and of itself was another, you know, essentially subsection of these kind of religious cults that were set up and what have you. I mean, a lot of it was sponsored by the Unification Church of Sun, Mayan, Moon, who conversely was also in league with you know, the Noetic Science Institute and people like Lewis Harmon and what have you. So, you know, there was kind of, as strange as it may sound, a kind of a similar financial patrons behind some of these groups. And certainly now, as the one has run its course, you're starting to see the reemergence of the other one. And definitely, you know, it does beg the question, is this an attempt to roll out some kind of new religion? Is it an attempt to spur a major backlash from the diminishing Christian fundamentalists that's going to become militant? I mean, there's definitely a lot of factors in play here and how all this is going to ultimately play out.
And something else we're seeing along those lines is occult symbolism, but not just symbolism, just outright occult in film and movies and TV shows. When you scroll through Netflix, you know, every other show is about witchcraft or demons or Satanism or something like that. Is that something you're seeing as well?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I was kind of funny. I was about to point out Netflix, which you just bringing that up, but I mean, yeah, I mean, definitely when you consider that really a lot of the best, you know, quality stuff is being done in the TV medium now, and a lot of it is on Netflix or Amazon Prime or some of these other streaming services. And as you're saying, I mean, it's definitely knee deep in a lot of these, you know, arcane subjects that were previously maybe, you know, confined to like the X-Files and a couple of other major shows. I mean, now this stuff is everywhere, and you're even seeing a lot of the old war horses like X-Files and Twin Peaks and so forth coming back. So, I mean, definitely, I mean, I do think some of this is an attempt to roll out some of these maybe more arcane beliefs. I mean, I definitely thought Twin Peaks The Return really, you know, had some really compelling stuff in that regard, especially the one episode, I believe it occurred in the middle of the season, that was primarily in black and white. And I think David Lynch was essentially trying to indicate with this that when we exploded the first atomic bomb at the Trinity site, it opened up a portal into this world that something came through that was, you know, a distinctly negative consequence, you know, probably for humanity as a whole. And really, the most recent season seems to have been about just the gradual decline of the nation because of the result of this evil. I mean, Twin Peaks was, during the original run, just a completely idealized small town with maybe small hints of darkness that surrounded the Laura Palmer murder, whereas in the new season, you're seeing how, you know, people are randomly shot by just a kid, you know, accidentally handling his community has become perverted. And this is really, you know, broader context of what has happened in the United States as a whole.
And earlier, we briefly touched on the transhumanism movement, but there's another aspect that goes along with it, and it's the assault on our human body, you know, with all the just crappy, disgusting food that we're being forced to eat, the water, the air. It just seems to coincide with this transhumanism movement. In a way, when you look back, it's like they're trying to make us less of humans physically as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's absolutely the case. And that, you know, kind of going back to Epstein is what's so unsettling about, you know, his forays into genetic research. I mean, certainly some of my readers have suggested to me that the elite might already be doing genetic modifications on their so forth. I mean, that's something at play. And I mean, you know, where does the end game go to this? I definitely think that there's a strong possibility it could really lead to the emergence of a species that was distinctly not human, though it might have originally, you know, come from humanity. But I mean, eventually you have all these genetic modifications, the different codes that are brought in to the human organism, and, you know, where does it lead to? What happens if we start, you know, or should say the elites start, you know, growing tentacles or something like that? I mean, certainly, as I've kind of speculated very wildly in my blog, you know, maybe we're seeing the emergence of Lovecraft's The Old Ones, but something that's essentially been created by these, you know, mad forays into genetics and this attempt to try to transcend humanity itself and transcend death and so forth. Is this where, you know, we lead to these ancient entities that are, I mean, almost horrendous, you know, to our very perception? It definitely leads to some very unsettling avenues of thought, to put it mildly.
Yeah, definitely. It makes me think of, you know, some of the theories that people think of CERN, that they're trying to open portals, you know, to different dimensions and stuff like that.
Yeah. That's another staple, too. The Twin Peaks definitely tapped into, I got to say. And it's not just David Lynch either. Mark Frost, the other kind of co-creator and co-writer, I mean, he wrote two really compelling books that were linked into the new series that dealt with a lot of the UFO stuff and what have you. And Frost has definitely done some interesting research, I can tell, just from reading them. And obviously Lynch has already kind of got one foot in the mystical, so to speak, to begin with. So, yeah, I mean, really, that was one of, I think, the best adaptations recently of what's really going on. And, you know, it's definitely something you could spend a lot of time analyzing in terms of what's happening in the modern world.
Definitely. Now, you know, to close out tonight, we are already living in what has become a dystopian society. Do you think that it's going to continue along this path? We're going to become more like a, you know, 1984. We're going to become more censored, more cameras everywhere, more surveillance. Or do you think that we have a way out of it? I do see a lot of people waking up to things, people that I never thought would notice some of this stuff, like my own parents are actually kind of noticing some things I never thought they'd notice before. So what are your thoughts about our future when it comes to this?
Well, I mean, I definitely think that, yes, there's a chance. I mean, we can break out of this. I mean, as I, you know, kind of said earlier, I don't think that the elite are omnipotent. They make mistakes. They are fallible. So certainly, and, you know, you kind of factor in that there's also an ongoing civil war. I definitely think there's a lot of opportunities for, you know, genuinely grassroots movements to take a hold and so forth. It's going to be very difficult, but I mean, I do think that the possibility exists amongst all the chaos that is currently unfolding. But I mean, I definitely think we are heading to chaos. It would not surprise me in the United States if not, you know, an actual civil war. We do see kind of a low key, you know, kind of acts of terrorism and so forth being carried out by, you know, far right and far left factions in equal measures and so forth. And, I honestly could see, I mean, almost more of a cyberpunk future than a 1984 type future, where you really see a complete breakdown in civil authority, which leads to the rise of private military companies and so forth. I mean, certainly this is something I think a lot of people behind Trump would really love to see happen in the near future. And, you know, that kind of goes into the perception that some of these groups have as a modern day Knights Templar or Knights of Malta or something to that effect. I mean, these were basically private, you know, militaries that really were more powerful than what a lot of the European kingdoms of that era possessed. And as such, they wielded a tremendous amount of transnational power across, you know, Europe and much of the Mediterranean. And I certainly think there are some groups that would love to see a return to that, where you essentially have, you know, companies with their own, maybe the British East India Company would be even a better example of a company essentially that controls mass amounts of resources, that has its own military, that has its own intelligence service, that essentially many of the national governments are subservient to. And that could be ultimately an end game of a civil war in the United States, if it does unfold. If America is broken down into smaller states, which seems to be an ongoing concern with Russia and China as well, would they possess national governments that could legitimately oppose the corporations if they really wanted to? You know, these are all things that are in play. So, I mean, I don't think that the future is set. There are definitely multiple different outcomes. Some of them you could see a genuinely grassroots movement come up. Some could lead to something like 1984. Some of them could lead to a neo, you know, East India Company controlling a lot of the world. I mean, but certainly, you know, a lot of these options are not necessarily the best ones.
Yeah, we definitely live in fascinating times. And I want to thank you so much for coming on tonight. Before you head out, let everyone know where they can find your work.
You can find it at my website, Visup. That's Visup View, essentially. So you do that with .blogspot.com. Should bring you right up. And also, like I said, I've got the book forthcoming with Frank Zero and Jeremy Knight. You know, hopefully we're going to get that out sometime early next year, maybe a little sooner. And we should hopefully be doing our own regular podcast, maybe some YouTube videos and so forth in the near future. That's going to be really cool. It's going to, you know, kind of give us an outlet to go into some of these more arcane topics that I haven't done as much on my blog. I've got the Epstein book in the works. Like I said, I've already kind of started plotting out this third book on the secret history of consciousness, you know, and so forth. I got a lot of things in the pipeline. You know, you can already see some of the stuff at the blog, but there should be a lot of other cool stuff that's coming out in the next couple of months. So,
very cool. Looking forward to that. And we're going to have you back on after those books come out.
I'd love to, man.
Awesome. Well, you have an excellent night. And thanks again for coming on.
Thank you for having me.